Today, why are millions of people fleeing from Venezuela? And, in opinion, The Guardian's Mona Chalabi on why it matters that police forces are so white.
The Amazon Highway is a 215-kilometre road that cuts into northern Brazil, into the Brazilian Amazon from southern Venezuela. I was there in April this year to report on what they call the Hunger Highway. And you have huge groups of Venezuelans trekking down this highway in scorching heat, trying to find work and to start new lives. You know, I met psychologists, I met street sweepers, people who used to work for the Venezuelan's oil giant, PDVSA, all fleeing for their lives.
This is how Tom Phillips, The Guardian's Latin America correspondent, began reporting on the Venezuelan crisis. He met people pouring out of a country which is very difficult for journalists to get into.
I stopped not far from the border and met a group of almost a dozen young Venezuelan men who were trekking. A lot of them had holes in their shoes. I asked them what they were running from, and they said, "We're running from insecurity and poverty." They sounded and they looked awful. They were sunburnt, they were exhausted, they were famished. And they were gearing up for a walk of up to 10 days through the Brazilian Amazon and with not a penny between them.
Venezuela is in dire economic straits. 2 weeks ago, Tom travelled to the country.
I felt a great sense of foreboding when I was flying into Caracas. I didn't really know what to expect, but the situation there is it just beggars belief, really.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, it's 20 years ago to the day that Hugo Chavez was elected president, promising a great new future for his country. So why are millions now fleeing Venezuela? What was it like arriving in Venezuela? Tell us about your first few days.
I wasn't really sure what to expect, how bad conditions would be. And the airport is not a particularly reassuring place to touch down at. There are frequent power cuts. There's no water. And once you're into the country, the highway from the airport into town was completely devoid of vehicles. I mean, really spooky. And once you're into town, there are whole areas of town which don't have any light. So at nighttime, it's really like being in an earthquake zone. I mean, really just very, very eerie.
You know, the next day, when you could look around and see what was going on, did you immediately understand why so many people were fleeing?
It's very odd, because when you look, the first morning in Caracas, I went up onto the roof of my hotel and looked down on the city. It's a gorgeous setting, the mountains to the north of the city that separate it from the Caribbean Sea. And amazing, because there's some gorgeous architecture in Caracas, and you really get the sense that until a few years ago, it would have been a wonderful place. And you go down to street level, and there are moments when you sort of feel you could be anywhere in Latin America. And then you start looking at the graffiti and it says, you know, "Enough hunger, down with the dictatorship, get out Maduro." And you start to see signs of the protests that rocked Venezuela last year. And you start going around, you see the huge queues for public transport and realise that even in middle-class neighbourhoods there are buildings that have no electricity, no water, because public services have completely broken down. Everywhere you go, everyone you talk to reminds you of the crisis. There's no one who is not touched in some way by it. Hyperinflation means that there are families basically living off sacks of maize because they've got nothing else to eat. The minimum monthly wage is 1,800, and that buys you about 4 packets of spaghetti. A chicken in Venezuela costs about 500.
Did you see hunger?
You see hunger constantly. In Caracas, you see young street kids, and I also saw elderly men picking through heaps of rubbish that have been left uncollected on street corners looking for morsels of food. I remember on my last evening there, I saw a man, an old man in downtown Caracas, pick up a carton of milk that had been thrown away into the rubbish, and he was pouring drops of it out onto his hand and tasting it to see if the milk had gone off and if he could drink it or not.
Oh my God, people must be literally starving.
Yeah, people are literally starving. I mean, one elderly lady I met, she had lost 14 kilos.
So what is your name?
Rosemary.
Rosemary.
So what was it like to meet Rosemary?
It was actually a gigantic pleasure to meet Rosemary. She was one of those wonderful people who you run into completely by accident in journalism with a wonderful story. She is the daughter of a British economist from Southampton and had lived for most of her life in Venezuela. And I met her at a food bank that had been set up by members of the Venezuelan diaspora. She's a linguist and had spent her career working at some of the best language universities in Caracas. And now found herself, because of the crisis, starving to death. I mean, she lost 14 kilos in a very short space of time.
But we're not producing anything. We used to produce corn and rice and vegetables, okay? Now we don't have this kind of thing. The government.
Some people have called it the Maduro diet because they blame it on the current president, Nicolas Maduro, the food shortages and the hyperinflation, but it is real and it is deadly.
Because nothing is produced anymore.
Nothing.
Was she angry about that?
She wants to see more protests. She thinks that Venezuelans should be out on the streets more, demanding an end to this government. But of course, that's really difficult. There were huge street demonstrations last year that were put down with deadly force in cities across the country.
So you then left Caracas. Were things any better once you left the capital?
As you head out of the capital, actually, things just get worse and worse and worse. So in Barquisimeto, we ended up visiting a shanty town and walked to the family home of Ivan Enriquez. And it was very, very odd. And we walked into his front yard. There was music in the air. He's a classical music fan, and he was listening to Bach full blast as his kids did their homework around the desk. And kids had wonderful handwriting and were very interested in education. But it was a scene of absolute deprivation. I mean, there was rubbish, garbage everywhere. His six children sat around a quote-unquote table in their garden. The table was a smashed door that had been propped up on four breeze blocks. Ivan, his wife, and their six children, aged 11 months to 13, all they had to eat in that house was a big sack of maize and a few sticks of cassava that were in a filthy fridge that wasn't even turned on because they were trying to save electricity.
How did they feel about the future for their children?
I mean, I really detected and was humbled by their utter determination to get through this, to make sure their kids got an education. But at the same time, just, I mean, absolutely bleak. And they said, it's madness.
Mira, a pesar de que yo tuve una infancia donde también no, yo no era de...
I mean, 90% of Venezuelans now live in poverty, so almost the entire country.
Because it's pretty shocking. I mean, it's shocking to hear a story like this anywhere in the world. It seems particularly shocking to hear it in the country that has more oil than anywhere else.
Yeah, it's absolutely... I mean, it's frankly, it's unbelievable. I think you can trace the root of all this to three basic things. One is the collapse in the price of oil since 2014. The other is just mind-boggling corruption. And the other is economic mismanagement. Venezuela has the largest proven crude reserves on earth. And yet when we reached Barinas, which is the state where Hugo Chavez was born and raised, we saw these immense queues for petrol, which locals told us were the result of a lack of transport. The government wasn't able to get the petrol to the stations anymore, but also the fact that production has collapsed. So as we were driving out into the countryside, I just decided to start counting the cars.
46, 47, 48, 49.
There were people sleeping on top of cars, inside their cars, waiting. And there were queues that were 150 cars, 200 cars long. It was incredible.
59, 60.
Even in this country that is sitting on such huge wealth, this huge reserves of black gold, you queue for days now to get half a tank of petrol.
19,
but the country wasn't always like this, was it?
Venezuela in the 1950s was one of the most glamorous, cosmopolitan places in Latin America.
From a vast slum area, this fine new district has arisen. Huge blocks of flats, all built in super modern style, can house 6,500 people.
Flights coming from all over the world. wonderful works of architecture going up.
Venezuela's president opens a new road, which, like all the new projects, was built with the country's fabulous oil income.
You know, economically rich, culturally rich.
South America's largest hospital is another new building.
A healthcare system that was the envy of the region. Up until quite recently, you had, for example, Brazilians jetting into Venezuela for plastic surgery. I mean, it was a prosperous place.
And how important was oil?
Oil has been, for the last century, critically important. And I think part of the economic pickle that it is now in is down to that dependence.
So just set the stage, 1998. Tell us what was happening in the country before Hugo Chavez came to power.
So Hugo Chavez was a former paratrooper who had tried and failed to launch a coup in 1992. He swept to power, a landslide, on December the 6th, 1998, promising to completely remake this country, to reduce its dependency on oil and to usher in a new Bolivarian era of social justice, direct democracy and people power. Nosotros representamos la esperanza
del pueblo. Es ahí la explicación de nuestra popularidad. And he brings in Chavismo.
Exactly, he brings in Chavismo. The basic ideals underpinning it were that Venezuela, like many Latin American countries and indeed countries around the world, had become deeply divided and were being ruled by the rich for the rich. And Chavez wanted to focus on the people at the bottom. There was an excitement, the sense that real change, social change, was in the air.
So Hugo Chavez was a hero to many people. He seemed to be doing something in which the intentions certainly sounded great. What started to go wrong?
So there are those who believe that this whole crisis is the fault of Nicolas Maduro, the current president. But I think many people actually trace it back far earlier than that, even to the early years of Chavismo. He was pumping huge sums of money into social projects. He was also sending huge quantities of Venezuelan oil overseas to help out friendly nations and doing oil diplomacy.
Just tell me what oil diplomacy is.
Well, he was buying friends and international support with Venezuelans' oil.
Giving it away.
And the sums just didn't add up.
And what were the social projects that he was pumping money into?
I mean, you really see evidence of that social legacy everywhere. Apartment blocks, some of which are stamped with Hugo Chavez's face. Council estates that have been signed by Chavez on the side. The problem now is that a lot of these places are falling apart because there simply are not the funds to keep going.
How has Venezuela got to this point?
That's a really, really complex question, and different people will give you different answers. But I think a huge part of it is economic mismanagement. A huge part of it is corruption. Last week, Chavez's former treasurer was sentenced to 10 years in prison in the US for taking more than $1 billion in bribe. So thieving politicians is a big part of it. And another huge part of it is falling oil prices, which have absolutely kneecapped the revolution since late 2014 onwards. So Maduro, the current president, in a way has inherited something of a poison chalice from Chavez because he no longer has the financial means to do social programs, basic infrastructure works that Chavez made his name introducing to Venezuela.
I mean, I remember when Chavez died, it was huge news.
Part funeral, part carnival, and all jam-packed. Today, miles of mourners said goodbye. And look closely, protected by those paratroopers, the man in the yellow tracksuit. He's Nicolas Maduro, Chavez's hand-picked successor.
But by that time, 2013, Venezuela was well into economic depression. The man who was chosen successor to Chavez was Nicolas Maduro. Tom, who is he and how did he come to power?
Maduro was Chavez's vice president. He was elected actually by the skin of his teeth.
Did he do something to try to tackle some of these economic problems?
Maduro unveiled this supposedly visionary, expertless plan to tame hyperinflation towards the end of August. The idea was to raise the minimum wage by 3,000%. He lopped lots of zeros off the end of the currency, introduced a new currency called the soberano, the sovereign bolivar. If you turn on state TV in Venezuela at the moment, you sort of enter this bizarre Panglossian world of social projects and tourism conferences. And
en nombre del presidente Nicolás Maduro por inaugurada esta feria internacional de ciencia y tecnología. Muchísimas gracias.
Venezuela striding out onto the world stage despite an imperialist global attack, but the reality is, you know, doesn't take 5 minutes to realize it is not working. One analyst I spoke to recently said that Venezuela was in a death spiral and it was just impossible to see how it was going to get out of that.
Oh my God. We know people are afraid to protest. Are people afraid to be part of the political opposition?
The Venezuelan opposition at the moment, I think, is just utterly splintered. I mean, some parts of it are in exile, others are in under house arrest or in jail. I mean, that is part of the problem. What comes, if Maduro does go, what comes next? And I, you know, after 2 weeks there, I just come away with the conclusion that actually no one has a clue.
Did you see any hope for Venezuela? Anything that can possibly pull the country out of this current situation?
The most hopeful thing I did see there in a really dire situation is just the utter determination amongst nearly all of the people I met somehow to push through to the other side. People like Ivan, who are just intent on educating their kids so that once things do improve, they can have a brighter future.
Why won't the government accept any aid?
So the government has been long in denial that this is a major humanitarian crisis, and they have been refusing foreign aid. Last month, the UN announced just over $9 million, but that's a drop in the ocean. And the problem is that the government seems to view aid as a kind of acceptance that Venezuela is crumbling, and they obviously fear that that might bring forward the day in which some kind of military intervention to sort out the situation comes.
Is that likely?
I don't think it's very likely, but I think it's possible. Venezuela is increasingly short on friends. On one of my last days there, I tried to go and visit the mausoleum in Caracas where Chavez's remains are. And as we approached, we saw all these official cars, and it seemed like a very senior member of the government was obviously visiting, and military, and got back to the hotel, and it turned out it had been one of North Korea's top leaders. And there was a live broadcast on the nightly news. And it just really struck me how isolated and friendless this once very cosmopolitan South American country now is.
Where is all of this headed?
I still don't think the world has quite grasped the severity of the situation in Venezuela. Venezuela's population is just over 31 million. About 10% of the population has left in the last 3 years. Having spent the last couple of weeks there, I'm really convinced that we just have not understood the scale of the crisis and the potential consequences for the rest of the region and the world.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read all of Tom's reporting from Venezuela at theguardian.com. Coming up, why it's a problem that Britain's police still don't look like the diverse communities they serve. Now, in opinion, and as part of The Guardian's week-long Bias in Britain series, Mona Chalabi argues that the slow pace of change in diversifying Britain's police is not only harmful, it's counterproductive in the fight against crime.
So as of March 2018, 93% of police officers in England and Wales are white. But we know that actually 86% of the population in England and Wales is white. So there's a huge gap there in terms of the police officers and the communities that they're serving. Improvements are being made, but they're happening so slowly that my colleagues have calculated that it's going to take 34 years to reach the same levels of ethnic diversity in the police force as we have in the broader population today. Which sounds incredible, right? This idea of waiting until 2052 to have even remotely any kind of representation. Actually, the reality is it's probably going to take much longer than that, because the population of England and Wales is changing. Even once the police force has caught up with today, the population would have moved on. If the police force doesn't represent the communities that they're serving, A consequence of that is frequently more public distrust in police, particularly among these communities. They're going to be less inclined to call the police. And if that first line of defence isn't there, then what does that say about our societies? How are they supposed to function if they can't rely on law enforcement? I think it's fair to assume that part of the reason why stop and searches disproportionately target people of colour in this country is because there are fewer people of colour serving on the police force. Black people are 8 times more likely to be stopped and searched by the police than white people. As far as I can see, there's not data that breaks down those stop and searches beyond race. So I'm interested in how this looks when you also take into account age and gender, because my perception is that it's overwhelmingly young black men that are being stopped. And what's interesting is some of the research that has been done by a group called Stopwatch, which is a group that's campaigning for more inclusive policing. In a report which they published this summer, they cite the experiences of one individual, and I'll quote from the report. He says, "Seriously, I was getting stopped 3 times a week. There were times I got stopped 3 times a day. That's a lot. That's the thing. That was so normal. Where I lived, it was so normal." Now, we also know that when the police do stop black people, they're far less likely to have drugs on them than in cases where they have stopped white people. Now, what that suggests is that they're being disproportionately targeted because of a belief that they're holding drugs when there are less grounds for that belief. Police aren't necessarily basing this on facts and evidence, they're basing it on hunches and racial stereotypes. Overall drug use is higher among white people than among any other racial or ethnic group, except for mixed ethnicity people. But Class A drug use is particularly higher among white people than among other ethnic groups. I think a lot of people are unaware of these statistics, particularly if they live in predominantly white areas, because they're not seeing the police stopping and searching people of colour. But I also think it's about the fact that even if they are, a lot of our depictions of people of colour in the mainstream media are quite negative, right? When we see a drug dealer on TV, who are they? Are they black or are they white? In some ways, a lot of these white police officers have been raised on the exact same depictions of people of colour that the broader public has been raised on. And so we're ready to accept that. So if you see the police stopping and searching a young black guy, particularly if you don't know that person, you're just going to think, oh, they've probably got a good reason for it. Especially if you already have a lot of faith and trust in the police. Whereas if already your faith in the police is shaken, then when you see that happening, you're thinking, God, they're harassing another member of my community. I'm even less inclined to pick up the phone and call them if things go wrong.
Do read all the coverage of the Guardian's Bias in Britain series on the website. My thanks to Tom Phillips and Mona Chalabi. Today's episode was produced by India Rackerson, Mithili Rao and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Kukutier. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.